This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeline Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, balancing the real and fantastical, writing relatable epic fantasy. So this week, Madeline gets put on the hot seat because turnabout is fair play, and she did this to me a few months ago. The Sons of Thestian is being re-released on the 24th of November. So now is a good time to ask her all the questions that hopefully she hasn't been asked before or that she hasn't answered publicly before.
So how does the revenge dish feel, Jules?
Pretty good.
Yeah, I thought so. No, fair's fair. I did do this to you, so I will try to answer these questions and not to ramble. Can't make any promises. Okay, hit me.
Right. I take it you don't mean literally, since...
No, please don't hit me literally.
Right, okay.
I mean, we're in different counties, so if you did manage to hit me somehow, then first of all, teach me your Jedi ways. Second of all...
Okay, this is no good. We're going off on a tangent already.
Sorry.
Right. With the re-release of Sons of Thestian, would you say that you've changed anything really, or you know, what's the benefit of the new and improved second edition?
Okay, so first of all, I just want to make a note to anyone who's listening and might have read the previous edition of the Sons of Thestian and be worried about it. You do not need to read the second edition in order to be able to understand Blood of the Delphi. I have not changed the story in any way. Everything is exactly the same. What I have done is that I have made it a more pleasant reading experience. I have improved the structure, really. Again, without moving anything around, I've just made it a little bit more linear, easier to read. I've looked up some problems I had with some of the grammar, and I've just given it a good old polish. It's had a bit of a renovation, but it's still the same story. So anyone who is reading, the advantage of the second edition is that you'll find that the story content is cleaner and clearer. My intentions for the story are easier to understand. There are probably a few extra little bits and bobs in there, nothing of significance, just things which will make the reading experience more enjoyable for the reader and sort of drop them a little bit more gently into the world so that they can enjoy the story more on a whole.
And I think now that obviously the tone is just a little bit more in line with the slightly possibly darker tone of Blood of Delphi.
Yeah, it's. I think the other thing is that it needed. Sons of Thestian was written when I was, you know, I was 17 years old, and I've said this hundreds and hundreds of times before. So sorry for repeating myself, but you know, I was young when I wrote it, and by the time I wrote Blood of the Delphi, I had developed more as a person. And as such, the writing, when I compared the writing for the Blood of the Delphi with the writing for the Sons of Thestian, it didn't match up. Usually quite often you'll see that there's a big difference, you know, in story and you see it particularly as well in comics and things like that, where if you compare the first edition with the last edition, you realize that the art style has been changing very slowly over time as people get more used to sort of drawing and they get more experience. It's the same with writing, and I matured as a writer. And so I needed to bring the Sons of Thestian up to a level which was a little bit closer to Blood of the Delphi. And unfortunately, every time I write a book, it's going to be a little bit more, it's going to be a little bit different as I secure my voice as a writer. And as I get older and as I'm affected by more experiences and more things in the world around me. So yes, that's one of the renovations that happened, is that the writing is now more in par with future books. I wanted to shine it up because, you know, I'm very proud of it as a book. I love it. And I'm not ashamed to say that I love this book. I have to have loved it. I spent hours and hours and hours on it. And I wanted it to be I wanted it to come out better, to the story to be reflected better with its presentation. And, you know, it was a dated presentation because it was written when I was younger and less knowledgeable and not quite as certain of what I wanted and how to get across what I wanted.
That brings me on to another question. You started writing The Sons of Thestian when you were really, really young.
Wasn't that young.
Well, it doesn't seem that young to you now, but it will do if you used to. No, what I would say is that you're, certainly from my experience and from a lot of other people I've spoken to, your mid to late teens and your early 20s, there's a big leap in, it's not that your entire mindset changes, it's just, and obviously that's something, if you're, you know, a reasonably limber person, that does keep evolving as you go on through life. But there is a big leap in how you view the world between those two times. You almost become a completely different person in some ways whilst sort of solidifying your own viewpoint.
Yeah, and I think that there is a huge leap when you leave school and you either go on to university or you do an apprenticeship or you start work. There's a big leap. You suddenly, life is different. And for me, university has been a mostly positive experience. You know, it was definitely the place that I wanted to be. And, you know, they say that up until, you know, when you're about in your late sort of mid-20s, when you're about 25, that's when your character solidifies. And that's when you sort of become the person that you're probably going to be for the rest of your life, if that makes sense. That's not to say you obviously won't continue to develop and change, but before that, I think there is the higher rate of change within us, because you're going through your teenage years and you're trying to find out who you are. So there's a lot of changes. I think I'm a different person than I was 6 months ago, let alone when I was 17. I've changed.
So, and you think that perhaps has obviously come out in the writing as well?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, just one small way it's come out in my writing is how I've started to incorporate more ideas of diversity and not be quite as afraid of them. You know, when I started writing The Sons of Thestian, I was coming to terms with my sexuality. I'd realized that I was bisexual. I didn't really quite know what that meant or how accepted it was, and so I knew Rufus was bisexual, but I just had it sort of, well, it's okay if I never mention that, I'll just keep it in the back of my mind, you know. And I was thinking in the same way Dumbledore was gay. It was very sort of, yeah, it's not relevant to the story, so, you know, why should I bother really mentioning it? Yeah. And then as I got older, I suddenly went, actually, I kind of do want to mention it. And I don't want to be that sort of quiet about it. And yeah, whilst I maintain, I'm not just going to force it in. Where there are opportunities to demonstrate this, there's no point ignoring it. So yeah, the Sons of Thestian, you don't actually see a lot of Rufus's bisexuality because during the time that it was being written, I didn't create any situations whereby you would see that. And in the rewrite, actually, I have made it a little bit more obvious. You see him flirt, his flirting is less subtle now with Embar Reagan.
Yeah.
And I mean, to be honest, with pretty much everyone he meets, he's does not hold himself back. And, you know, there's more implications about the relationship between Emmerich and Marcel as well. And I was more open about sexuality and sexualization, you know, self-sexualization, because I'd gotten older and I was no longer going, tee-hee-hee, I cannot possibly mention this. You know, I suddenly thought, actually, why not? So, yeah, and I think in Blood of the Delphi, I just, didn't bother holding back.
Yeah, as I said, Blood of the Delphi gets quite a bit darker quite quickly. Two paragraphs in. That's not to suggest in any way to anyone listening that obviously Blood of the Delphi is some sort of weird sex bondage type thing.
No, it absolutely isn't. But I suddenly realised that I was in charge of the story. And that it was no good saying, well, you know, there was just no opportunity for him to show his sexuality. Because I'm like, well, I could have created opportunity at any time because I was writing it. And whilst obviously I didn't really do it that much in the first book. It was because my main objective in the first book was about the story, and Rufus wasn't really going through a romantic period in his time because he wasn't going through a romantic period in his time due to issues and stuff like that. So he wasn't looking for romance. Second book is different. Second book, the circumstances are different. And so, yeah, I guess that's one way, one way that growing up has changed my writing.
I think that's a good point. I mean, obviously, as I said, you're a completely different person when you make that leap from your teens to your early to mid-20s, but that's obviously one big difference that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of myself. Okay, what was your original inspiration for both the book, The Sons of Thestian, and the series, and which one came first?
Okay, picture this. For a short period, well, for about 4 years, 5 years, I was living in The Hague with my family. And one Christmas, I was there for Christmas, and I used to get the tram to a place called Centraal, where I'd just like to go in there. That was where the cinema was, it was where the shopping was. And there's some beautiful, beautiful architecture in the Netherlands. Some really amazing buildings. And I was walking back towards the main station so that I could get the tram home. And it was very quiet. There was very few people around. The evening was coming in, and I walked past this big building. It wasn't a church, it looked like an official building of some sort. And I, to this day, I have no idea what it was. It was sort of some sort of town hall. It was this big kind of quite intimidating building, which I really, really liked. And I was walking past it and I heard a bell go somewhere and there was no one around. And I had my headphones in and, you know, my imagination ran away with me a little bit. And I suddenly thought, what if those bells were ringing? And now I have to hurry because after the bells go, no one is allowed out on the streets because that's when the monsters come out and as the darkness was coming in. And so actually the Sons of Thestian started with the night patrol, and it started with this idea that when darkness fell, the streets belonged to something else. The world, the night was a different sort of place, and it was these monsters. And if you were caught out, no one could help you. There was literally, it wasn't a case of fighting these things. There was no competition. There was just you stayed in, and that was it. And there was nothing for it. And originally they were actually called Howlers. And then it changed to the Night Patrol. And I got home, and I had some friends staying, and I wrote the prologue to the Sons of Thestian. And then that was it. That just sat on my computer for several months before I suddenly went, oh, hold on, I'm going to pick this up again. I'm going to see what happens next. And originally, it was actually going to be something entirely different. It was going to be futuristic, urban fantasy, time traveling, multi-dimension kind of stuff. And somehow it turned into an epic fantasy instead. And the series was born. It was only going to be one book. And the series was born because in a flash, while I was writing it, I realized how the book was going to end. And I went, you know, it was this huge inspiration. You know, I was stumbled out of my chair. I was there like, oh my God. So that's it. That's how it ends. I see it. I see the whole thing. I cannot leave it there. Oh my God, I'm a terrible human being. I can't stop the story there. And so, yeah, the rest of the series was born by the realization of how the first book was going to end. And I couldn't leave it hanging in that way. I realized that I needed not to solve it, but I needed a kind of a solution that the characters needed to continue their story. Rufus in particular just couldn't let it lie. He just wasn't that kind of person. And thus what was one book became two books, became a trilogy.
There's two points I'd pick up from that. One is, obviously, the Night Patrol's a very sort of atmospheric presence.
Yeah.
But it's quite ambiguous whether they're actually a force for good or not.
I'm glad you point that out, because I'm going to talk about Zachary Anyone who's ever been in a room with me for more than half an hour knows how much I love to talk about Zachary.
I've actually got that written down as a question, and I've written it down thus, the problem of Zachary, question mark.
Let's talk about Arl and Zachary. So first draft, Arl and Zachary was just, and I'm sorry, you know, swear jar here, but he was just an asshole. He was a real stereotypical psychopathic villain. And his men followed him. Marcel followed him out of this kind of this sense of loyalty. This Marcel was kind of this sort of I don't really care character. He didn't really have a big moral compass as such. So Marcel followed him out of that. And Emmerich followed him out of fear because Zachary would actually threaten him quite often. And they all wanted that kind of power that the Night Patrol power gave them. But yeah, Zachary was not a good person. He didn't really have a reason for why he was doing half the things he was doing. He just kind of really enjoyed eating people, and he was just not a good person. And I didn't like him, and nobody liked him. And then as things were developing a little bit, and he hated Rufus because he was very, very jealous of him. As I was writing, however, and as I got into the second book, I realized I needed another perspective in the story. As, you know, Rufus sort of splits off, I need another perspective in Hamartia. And Zachary was the obvious choice. And I suddenly had to go into his mind and figure out who he was and what he wanted and what he was doing. And I found someone I didn't expect. And it was someone who... Well, there's the quote, which is that his bark is worse than his bite until he bites. And the idea of Zachary, actually, I realized, was that this was a man who believes he is a monster. He thoroughly believes he is a monster. He thoroughly believes he is a tool. And he has decided, or he says that he's decided, that he doesn't care if he's a monster, because he feels like if that's the role he has to play for the greater good, then fine, he'll do it. But the more I delved into him, I found just so many layers, and I rewrote The Sons of Thestian again to reflect those layers and to reflect the kind of the thing that he was going through. And he isn't actually, this is going to sound super cheap, he's actually Rufus. And I've written them like this on purpose. Rufus and Zachary are actually pretty much the same person. And the idea is, actually, if they swapped their lives, they would have turned out in a relatively similar kind of way. So that they're parallels of each other. They've always been parallels of each other. Rufus raised in a happy home, only child. Zachary raised very rich but unhappy home, many siblings, huge sense of responsibility, and both of them end up obviously being these apprentices. So Zachary is someone who pretends to be evil but isn't actually evil. And he's kind of unnerved by people realizing that he's not evil. People are like, no, I actually think you're very moralistic. And he's like, no, I'm not. Shush. But he is. And he actually wants the best, but he has this huge guilt complex and this huge chip on his shoulder. And he's very complicated. And I love him to bits. And the Night Patrol, this is going to be a little bit of a spoiler, so sorry anyone who was really looking forward to this. the Night Patrol get a lot of the blame for things, but there is a point, which is that the Night Patrol are literally soldiers doing what they are told to do. Which is, it's not that they've said, right, they're not the ones who put the curfew in place. What happened was, the curfew was put in place, the Queen said, I want the Night Patrol out there, and I want them to kill anyone who's out after curfew. The punishment for being out after curfew is death. So regardless of whether it was the Night Patrol or not, people would still die. It's just that the Night Patrol are actually very good at it. And Zachary actually gives a statistic in the second book, which is that he says that during the period when the Night Patrol were doing the curfew, crime rates dropped by about 60%. I think it's something along those lines, whereby actually the city became significantly safer. Because everyone was terrified.
Yeah, but then you've essentially got something that's under martial law.
Basically, yeah, and again, it's the kind of that balance thing, where it's a really harsh rule. But I think the problem is that you look at it with a very modern eye, and it's not actually a modern setting. You know, it's set the sort of the late Renaissance, and they're quite empowered by their knowledge and things like that. And yeah, the Night Patrol are definitely scary and they're definitely not good, but they are kind of tools and they do actually have a sort of honor to them. And given the chance, they will redeem themselves. And you know, it is said in the first book, Rufus does explain that when they were created, their design was actually something a lot more heroic. The idea was that they were meant to protect the kingdom. They were the last, you know, the first line of defense, the elite warriors. In that, they're meant to be the heroes of the people, but the queen turned them into the enemies of the people. And again, Zachary said, fine, if we need to be the enemies of the people in order to stop this country going into all-out war and everybody dying, then fine. And then you find out a little bit more about some of the stuff that happened and some of the people they killed when they were in the middle of the Night Patrol, and some of the people that they didn't kill. Anyway, sorry.
That's fine.
So yeah, that's my little Zachary, who is very complicated and is not a good guy. He is a good guy. He's trying so hard.
You can't actually help liking Zachary. I wasn't too bothered the first time I read it, and then the second time I read it, it was like, no, I really like Zachary. Zachary's cool. But then I'd read The Blood of the Delphi the second time.
Yeah, and
so I don't know if that perhaps informed into it a little bit.
It was quite interesting because people just, they're like, they finished the first book, they're like, I hate Zachary, and then they read the second one, they're like, oh, Zachary. Which is why it's interesting. I've got people reading it now and they're like, yeah, Zachary's my favorite character. I'm like, if you love him in book one, you're gonna you're really not gonna be happy with me in book two.
No. They're going to take after you with torches and pitchforks.
The other interesting thing was, again, because Rufus and Zachary are parallels. Zachary's relationship with Sverin is obviously a parallel with Rufus's relationship with Yonat. You start to wonder, if you had followed Zachary from the start with his relationship with Sverin, would more people be rooting for him? Because Rufus does some
dubious is the right word.
Okay, he definitely does some dubious things for Yonat, which we all kind of go, well, it's just because he, you know, he loves him. And we overlook some of the things that sort of Rufus does. And I wonder whether actually if we saw the relationship from the start of Zachary and Sverin and knew about Zachary from the beginning, a more people would be sympathetic for him. But interestingly enough, actually, people who read the book and loved Yonat hated Zachary, and people who read the book and loved Rufus were kind of more sort of lent a little bit more to Zachary. So
yeah. No, I can see that. That brings me on to the second point that I was going to make before, but that was a nice little segue. And that's, weirdly enough, when we start out with the Sons of Thestian, you feel like Yonat is actually the main character, which he is in a lot of ways. And then the end of book one happens, and we realise that halfway through, you've switched main characters on us, and we don't necessarily notice it at the time.
Yeah, I think a lot of people got confused because they assumed that Yonat was the main character. And yeah, he is definitely a main character, the main character. But Rufus, it's shared between the two of them. But
I think it is. It's just that Yonat tends to really your sort of gateway character at the beginning, because Rufus keeps secrets from us.
He does, and Yonat is the one who brings us into the story, and in some way. Book one is Yonat's story. Was Yonat's story, and Rufus is a supporting character in that, who in some way, the end of book one is Rufus's origin story, if that makes sense.
Yes. Yeah, it does.
So yeah, we see so yeah, you're right in that they're both the main characters, but it is Yonat's story. And it is about Yonat's progression, because he's the one who progresses the most and the one who develops the most throughout the story. And then book two is a lot more about Rufus and Zachary.
This is quite a good one for epic fantasy, and that is about managing a large cast of characters and several kingdoms and countries.
I have one word for you, Jules. It's regret. So much regret. So
why didn't I make it a small story about people living and dying in one village?
Well, it started off quite small, and then it grew as the ideas grew and the world grew and the religion grew. the amount of times I've stopped and questioned myself and said, yeah, but did I have to create 10 gods? And then you've got the she gods. And then the Fomori came into it. And oh God, there's so many gods. and then you've got all the kingdoms. And not only that, you've got the different areas in the kingdoms, the different people who live in the kingdoms. You know, you've got the Cathracs, you've got the Isnes, you've got the Ishti. You've got the Hamartians, and Hamartians are actually the easiest lot because they're just Hamartians and that's it. You've got the Bithynians, and you've got the there's two races of Bithynian, and they've got several accents and depending where you are, and then there's the Avalonians, and then you've got East Rene and West Rene, who had a revolution, and it got very complicated very fast. And honestly, I think it would be a lie to say that the political climate and the way that the world kind of works doesn't reflect how I see the world now.
Yeah.
And I think the reason actually it got as it was and got so complicated was because I kind of actually got tired of non-complicated things. I didn't want it just to be the sort of the Mordor-esque, well, that's where the bad people are and this is where the good people are, you know. It was more about that place has got some really bad governments in place, but it's got some lovely people in it. And this place, they're happy, but, you know, they've got some pretty shifty deals going on. And this place is a democracy, but, you know, they have a really bloody history and they're pretty much constantly at war, you know. I wanted it to be a more realistic view that actually there is no ideal way to rule and there's no ideal country. There are places which seem more progressive than others, but you know, you see Bithyn, and Bithyn is meant to be this paragon of you know, is meant to be wonderful. Everyone's, you know, talking about, we see Bithyn in book one. And it just seems great, doesn't it? Everyone I've ever, who's read the book I've met, have said, yeah, I'd love to go to Bithyn. And I point out that the only bit of Bithyn they see is Sarantown.
Yeah.
And, you know, Brutar points out to Faye that actually, yeah, the Bithynians have this great wealth and peace and stuff like that. But they pay an extortionate amount of money every year to the Shi in order to kind of to be able to get that. And I'm not going to lie, that was definitely an EU reference.
Yeah.
And yeah, they compromise certain things. And the other thing, and you see Saren, and it was about that kind of short-sightedness, which is that Saren is this small slice of paradise, but not a lot actually happens there. It's kind of meant to just be a place where time stands still. And actually in the second book, we're going to see more of Bithyn, and we're going to see some of the lesser, the not quite so nice parts of Bithyn, including Lemra. And we see a place called, we see Brexium. And yeah, we see some of the not quite so romanticized parts of Bithyn, which show that it is just as any country, that if you came to England and you only ever saw Bath Spa, you know, you only ever went to Bath, you wouldn't be able to imagine what Hull looks like. different countries will have different places. So I think that was my inspiration for why I created so many worlds. And I think actually managing them, once I got the hang of it, wasn't too difficult, because I stopped trying to define each country by any one thing, the good country, the bad country. And I said, this is just a country like the world that I live in.
But how did you manage to keep your cast straight in your head? And remember who was supposed to be where and not accidentally transpose and put them in the wrong country?
Well, I'm pretty sure Faye turned up in Brexium at one point accidentally. You recall you were editing it and you're like, well, I'm not sure why she's there, but like just a nanosecond I wrote Faye instead of Luca.
Yeah, that's right. I do remember that.
She teleported. Well, I think it helped that in the end I decided that I was only going to, I didn't pull a George R. R. Martin, in that actually the focus does remain on a few select characters.
Yeah.
Even though there are lots of characters, that the focus does tend to remain on a few select ones. And actually, more than keeping track of where all of the characters were, the thing I really struggled with was keeping track of time between the two places, because obviously, you know, I'd try to break up the story where you'd flip from one character to the next, so that it would stay interesting, so you wouldn't always be following only one character. And of course, the problem with that is that I suddenly found that I was writing about Rufus doing something one day, and then I sort of flipped to Zachary, and it would be like several days later, and then I flip back to Rufus, and it would be the same day, and I was like, no, hold on a second, this order doesn't work. The time has to be the same. The same amount of time passes in the Neve as it does in in Hamartia. Time does not operate on a different scale. So actually, it wasn't so much keeping track of all where the characters were, it was keeping track of when all of the characters were, that proved to be very tricky, actually, because they were all over the place. And of course, all in different time zones, too, just to complicate things.
And obviously you've got quite, I wouldn't say complicated, but you have got quite a full magic system as well to keep track of.
Yeah, it was actually used to be even more complicated. I did actually simplify it a lot. It did actually used to be significantly more complicated. And it just got confusing because obviously there's several different modes of magic. There's human magic. And then there's, you know, the fairy magic, which is different, and people got confused by it. And then all the gods and I get confused by it.
Yeah.
The word regret, again, springs to mind.
I think that's one of the things with all kinds of fantasy, but particularly epic fantasy, is you need to put limitations on magic, because if you have a society where some people have got magic and some people haven't, if the magic people can literally just snap their fingers and solve everything, then you lose all the tension.
Yeah. And I think actually one way that I sort of did that was that magic, the magi magic, is compared to mathematics. Yeah. That actually any human can do magic. The idea is that it's like complex mathematics or complex engineering. Anyone has the potential to do it, but in order to do it, you have to understand what you're doing. I mean, it often takes a little bit of work and a little bit of understanding. For those who've done a lot of practice of it, they can do it quickly. For those who haven't, it can take a long time to sort of figure out. And the reason Rufus is a genius is that he can do it almost instantly. He figures things out very quickly in his head. But he's also then affected by the things around him. So if he's panicked, if you're panicked, it's going to be a lot harder to figure out a formula. If you're in a rush, if you're being chased, if you're in pain.
You know, I would be so dead. I would be so dead in your world. If it depended on a complex mathematical equation that I had to do in my head before I could do any magic, I'd just be dead. It's just, that wouldn't happen.
But yeah, that's the idea, is that it's maths, basically, or a variant equivalent of, which is that they can't just throw around the elements. And when Rufus sort of loses it a little bit, he does just kind of blithely throw around the elements, because it's a lot of guesswork for him, which is, again, why they're kind of intimidated by him. And they're kind of, it's why it's a surprise when he starts mimicking their sort of magic. Again, when he's fighting Zachary and Marcel and Emmerich, he mimics their magic, and Zachary's there like, whoa, when did you learn to do that? And Zachary and Rufus is there like, oh, I just learned to do it this afternoon. And Zachary's there like, I hate you. We spent years coming up with this, and you just watched us and copied us. He's such a... It makes me think of... Okay, I'm going to talk about A Court of Thorns and Roses again, because I can. Court of Thorns and Roses, where one thing I did find objection with is that you've got Rhysand, obviously, who's... You never actually really understand the limit of all of their power and what they can and can't do.
No.
Like...
It's left quite amorphous, isn't it?
Yeah, that can they... Like, what can and what can't they do? It's just... It seems to be that they can do pretty much anything. They seem to be able to bend reality to their will.
Yeah, it's and only it, when you see them up against sort of the ancient, more godlike creatures that you think, oh, there are limitations.
Yeah, but you at the same time, you only have to you can only assume that they're limitations. You don't really understand. And I think in some ways that it sort of works, because that is very, you know, that does kind of echo how mythology was, is that you'd often have all these characters in Celtic mythology who had these amazing powers to be able to do all this stuff. And then when actually they could have been doing all that stuff, they didn't. And then they died, you know.
Oh, actually, I was reading the old Russian fairy tale, The Firebird, and I think it's Ivan the Grey Wolf and the Firebird. And halfway through that fairy tale, it turns out that the Grey Wolf happens to be a shapeshifter who can just pretend to be the Firebird so he can be a substitute. And it's like, okay, someone didn't
this
really think this
time.
Through. You wait till halfway through the story. Yeah, again, it's that sort of yes, because of magic, rather than.
Yeah.
You know, the wolf had to go away to special wolf school and learn how to imitate a firebird.
Well, and actually it was that kind of because there's magic was the exact reason I created the Magi in the way that I did, is that I decided it wasn't just going to be because of magic. It had to be about brains, and it had to be about a level of luck as well. And the idea of the Magi is that it's actually a university. The idea is that it's a formal kind of education, and when you come out of it, you could become you can become a theorist, you can become an architect. So not all Magi are fighters. Some of them, you know, use the magic to do X, Y, and Z. You could be an ambassador, and not everyone who learns magic becomes a Magi. You know, you have to be the best of your field. It's the equivalent of getting a PhD is what being a Magi is. You become a professor, basically.
Yeah.
Which is why people who've said, so Zachary isn't actually that smart. I'm like, no, Zachary is very smart. But the problem, they're all very, very smart. The problem is Rufus is way too smart for his own good. That's what the problem is. And it was also, I think someone asked me once, who would win in a fight, Faye or Zachary? And that was a really hard one because it would really depend on a lot of things. It would depend on what time of day it was. If Zachary has his chosen element, Zachary's more powerful during the daytime actually than he is at night, because his chosen element, that he was born under a water star, he can use all the other elements, but water is his best one. It's the thing he specializes in, and you can only use the water element when the water star is in the sky. So if you attack him at night, he'll probably be weaker. Faye is not affected by the stars in the same way. And I liked the idea that, yeah, there are some people who definitely can't be defeated very easily, but that it was never just, well, I'm all powerful and that's that. It was always about, actually, if you come at this correctly, we are as driven by circumstance and our emotions, and there's no infallibility, if that makes sense.
Do warm more to a magical system where there is some sort of reason behind it, even if it's quite fantastical.
Yeah.
Like David Eddings, the Belgariad and the Malorian both have the will and the word, which is you must have the willpower in order to will something into being, but you have to have the correct words in order to give it shape. So it's like the Eastern idea of force and form, which you find in a lot of martial arts.
Yeah.
And then also you've got the Black Magician trilogy by Trudy Canavan.
Yes.
Which again is clearly very much a study, as it were. You have innate power, but you have to study in order to be able to use it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, she had the not everyone turned out in the same way. You know, I think she had, you could be a warrior, or you could be, or you could be a healer. You know, there were several different types that you could study.
Yeah,
to be.
And academics as well.
Yeah, it wasn't just, ta-da, now you're an all singing, all dancing. It was, you're going to learn, you can study magic, but in your kind of your chosen area, really.
And of course, being a black magician is the way to cheat the odds on all of that.
Yeah, so thanks for that. But no, and creating your own magical system in that way is... does allow you to have more control, and actually makes can allow your character to be more relatable, because it gets very, very boring if you just have a character that is just, it's nice if we can see a character and we can see their Achilles heel. And
yeah.
this isn't the Sons of Thestian, but with the Kestrel saga, the magic system is different in that she's actually focusing more on a kind of a different sort of magic, but she does something called belief magic, and so she has her own power, but in order to kind of make something a reality, she has to believe that it's a reality first, which everyone will say, well, that's really easy, but actually it isn't, because you have to really believe something is there when it's not. And you know, if you're being chased or something like that, it can be very hard to do, so it can take an extremely long time to kind of build up, and so it takes lack of concentration, lack of time to, and the reason you use spells is that spells which have been used for generations over time are kind of already imbued with belief magic because lots of people have used them, so lots of people know that they work, so it kind of already has a power to it to itself, which means that you can use spells to create something which hundreds of people have already done before, so you know it works, so you can believe it works. Or you can make up something on the spot, which is an incredibly risky and less likely.
Yeah, see, that just sounds like having a junior chemistry set and thinking, what happens if I mix all these things together?
It's a good analogy, actually. But yeah, the idea of the Sons of Thestian was that it was about being smart, and the Magi weren't actually warriors per se. They were scholars, and Rufus is a scholar. I wanted a character who was just smart and gets by not by being a warrior. He will never be a warrior, no matter, even if he becomes good at fighting, he will never be a warrior, because the thing that will make him good at fighting is that he'll outwit someone and then basically run away. That's his mode of attack, which set something on fire and flee.
Outthink, outrun, outlast.
Basically, yes.
Yeah, no, I do agree with you about magical systems, and there is something very frustrating about characters that just blast their way things with raw ability, and they've been helpless up until that moment, and then for some reason, I don't know, maybe because you're 10 pages off the end of the book, they just manage to get, you know, all this power just comes to them for no reason at all, and it's...
And that's okay if you say basically their magic is sort of connected with their emotions. Like,
I think that's a card you only really get to play in one book. I don't think that's a card you get to play continuously through, say, 12 books in a series.
Watch me.
But no, that's not something you're doing. This is something that, in particular, I'm thinking of Terry Goodkind, where you've got Richard Rahl, who just basically is pretty helpless through, like, 3/4 of each book, and then at the end it's like, oh yeah, I'm a war wizard, I've got more power than all the others put together, I'm just going to stand in front of an entire army and turn them to bones and dust.
Wait, what?
You're like, okay, where was that like 400 pages ago when you were boring us to death with fixing staircases?
Oh yes, the fixing of the thereby fixing society.
Yeah.
But I think there is another element to it, and I think as fighters, actually, you and I will be able to appreciate this, which is that if you are fighting someone who is incredibly skilled, you tend to up your game. And if you're fighting someone who isn't as skilled, that does actually tend to affect how you yourself fight. If you're fighting a scruffy fighter, it's actually very difficult to do clean punches and stuff like that. It descends quite quickly.
Yeah, I mean, unless you get in there really quick and take them out, yes, it does tend to then sort of make you look a bit rubbish.
Yeah, and so I think there is an element of that you can understand why someone could be defeated by someone who's less powerful, but then when they fight an even more powerful opponent, they're able to get into it, and it can be about the stakes. And I think another thing that we sort of forget about is the mental, that the huge influence of your mental well-being as you go into a fight. This is becoming about fighting, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You can just have a bad day and you can be off form, and then one day you can just be in better form, and suddenly that will be reflected in your power. So the magical systems, I'm all for complex magical systems. I'm not always for them when they're overly complex. I like having that level of spontaneity as well, saying actually, against all the odds, logic aside, something very human has come out of this, and that is what's actually given this person the power to keep fighting. I'm all for that trope. The reason I'm able to keep fighting is because I'm mortal and human, and therefore, you know, the one that makes no sense that you see all the time. It's just, they're like, but how could you defeat me? You're just a human. And you go, ah, but it's because I'm human. And I never get that, because I'm like, no, humans are pretty pathetic, but I'm always cheering them on.
No, I mean, I can kind of see that one. Not to going off on a slight tangent, but it's like, how is Romeo able to defeat Tybalt when he never would have been able to before Mercutio died? And it's the Hulk thing where,
yeah,
in cases of extreme stress, you've managed to find a strength that you wouldn't normally have access to. It's a survival thing whereby you could lift cars off people, and then you'd never be able to do it cold. it's that last bit of desperation to survive, I think. So yeah, I can kind of see that point there. I'm not sure how that plays into a magical system. But...
I think it could definitely play into a magical system. Because I think it's not just finding the strength, it's actually more the, you kind of shut off the warnings in your head that go, no, this is a terrible idea. Oh, you're ripping all your tendons.
You're less bothered about sort of damage and or your mind, actually, if it's magic, I suppose. Okay, what goes wrong, in your opinion, with epic fantasy? And I don't necessarily mean yours, I mean in general, when someone's writing epic fantasy and you've read some or seen it and you thought, oh, that hasn't been done very well, that's lost me a bit.
I think what goes wrong, and it goes back to characters again, and I mentioned I didn't do a George R. R. Martin, which is that I think it goes wrong when epic fantasy writers forget who their main characters are. And I, don't get me wrong, I have no problem with stories progressing and new characters coming in and new characters taking the spot. You know, as I've said, Yonat was the Sons of Thestian is Yonat's story. And then sort of Rufus really takes the torch. But Rufus was there from the beginning, you know, and Zachary was there from the beginning. We don't just have and I introduce more new characters in Blood of the Delphi who start to take more of a spotlight as it goes on. But I think when you're sort of 12 books down the line and you're like, you're reading it and you suddenly just go, who the hell are these characters?
Even better, where you go, you're 4 books in and you're like, okay, I haven't seen that character since book 1. Where are they? Mm. And they've just been left standing in a crystal cave for 2 years or something. And then they turn up again in book 5.
And I think it's at that point that you've got to remember that obviously you're putting a lot of time and effort into writing, but your readers are putting time and effort into submerging themselves into your world. And a part of why they're doing that is that they want to follow a set of characters. And it seems kind of a bit cheeky to me to say, you're in this because you wanted to see what happened to these people. Now I'm going to throw in these totally irrelevant people. And that's that. And I think a way to combat that is to basically say, create and involve all sorts of new characters whenever you want. That's absolutely fine. But even if you kill off a few of them, stick to your core set of main characters. And this is an area where I feel that the Game of Thrones TV series has done better than the Game of Thrones books.
Yeah.
In that, somehow in the series, we've managed to stay the whole way throughout with the characters that we started with. I mean, considering how many of them have died, that's pretty amazing. Whereas the books, and it was book 5, we suddenly got thrown off and you're reading it. And the characters whose point of view you're seeing things from are characters that you don't know and you haven't really been given the chance to give a shit about. You haven't been given a chance to care about them at all. And yet you're expected to. And there's this character, the Dornish Prince in Game of Thrones, who shows up in book, I don't know. And he shows up, you see a few sections of him, and, you know, he's talking about his relationship with his friends. And you're like, I might have actually been interested in this guy if it was book 1. But at this point, so many complicated things have happened. And I really just want to be sticking with the people I know. I don't have the time and energy to be with this new person who died a couple of chapters later. And that was that. And I was there like, it wasn't even a very good, you know, you didn't even really see him die. It was kind of, what was the point? I had no reason to get invested, and you made me sort of get invested, and then I got nothing out of it. This character did not. Yeah, so I think actually my biggest issue with epic fantasy is when you, it's fine to have lots and lots of characters, but you need to have your central main characters. You need to know who they are. You need to know who the first and the second and the third tier characters are. And yeah, that can shuffle around, but you need to maintain that a few of those first tier characters, because they're the ones that take us by the hand and draw us into the story. And it's like having a tour guide taking a group into a cave somewhere, and then the tour guide disappears and someone else goes, well, I've been here before, so I guess I can, you know, at some point anarchy is just going to break out. You need to keep us in the light. Yeah.
Though if you did that Game of Thrones style, then every so often the tour guide would periodically die in some horrible way and then you all would take over. So when you start thinking, I'm not volunteering for that job. It's like, you know what? I've been in this cave before. It doesn't matter. I'm just going to keep my hands down.
I'm rooting for that guy. Oh, he fell down a well. Anyway.
Someone so, yeah. comes in and you just go, just don't get attached to him. Seriously.
I'm not getting attached to you. You seem like a decent, nice person. You're gonna die. That's my main issue with epic fantasy.
Okay, so bringing it back to Sons of Thestion, which comes out on the 24th of November.
Yep.
Yep. And then, in theory, very shortly afterwards, the Blood of the Delphi.
Mm-hmm.
She's not panicked by the deadline at all.
No.
No. But, you know, reasonably soon we can probably expect Blood of the Delphi.
Yeah.
Give us a little teaser about Blood of the Delphi to end on.
Little teaser about Blood of the Delphi. It is... you're going to hate me. No. I'm very pleased with Blood of the Delphi. I feel that the Sons of Thestion was a strong foundation into the world. But Blood of the Delphi is really kind of where the epic element of the story starts. And you see the players begin to move. And a lot of people who've read Blood of the Delphi and then gone back to read the Sons of Thestion start to notice a lot of the pieces moving in the first book, which was just set as kind of foreshadowing. And now things really do start moving in a major way, and we get introduced to the real villains, actually, and the bigger picture. And it's very exciting. It's very exciting for me. And I can't wait to show you what I'm going to put these people through. I can't wait to get angry messages from people saying, I think one of my favourite moments of 2016. Oh, and there haven't been a lot of good moments in 2016.
Nope.
I think one of my favourite moments of 2016 was my other editor, Amelia, sending me messages and saying, God, Rufus has turned into a real wimp. Oh, God, he's such a crybaby. Oh, he really needs to get over himself. He needs to get over himself. And she's just sending me these messages. And then she went quiet. And then she read the chapter. And she sent me this message saying, oh, my God, I take it all back. Rufus, you take all the time you need. What did you do? And her outrage sustained me.
You got a few of those messages.
You did. I sorry, you didn't. You sent me some rather unpleasant messages.
I didn't mince my words.
You were not happy with me.
No, I'm still not happy with you.
I also feel that I'm pleased with Blood of the Delphi because I feel that actually it's a chance for Faye to come out more. Faye is very reserved in the first book, and we get to see an outside persona of her, and we only really get to see a little bit more of the inside of her at the end of the book when she has a kind of heart-to-heart with Rufus. Whereas Blood of the Delphi gives you an opportunity to see what her life is actually like. And we also get to introduce another awesome female character, Beatrice Hathley, Marcel's older sister, who is fantastic to write. She's great fun. And so we're introducing some great new characters, including Aaron, Beatrice, Varen. We get to meet Isaac as well, as well as all of the Neve lot. And I'm super excited for you guys to be meeting all of these. And for those who have no idea what I'm talking about so far, you can now pre-order The Sons of Thestion. It's on a special promotional price of 99p or 99 cents if you're in the US, and you can get that for Kindle on Amazon, or you can pre-order the physical copy as well. And yeah, it's coming out on the 24th, and I'm very nervous, and hopefully you should see Blood of the Delphi out in December, just in time for me to ruin your Christmas.
And it will. That no, doesn't mean you shouldn't read it.
You guys are gonna love it, I swear. I think I also got to be more humorous because I got to do more of Zachary, and Zachary's a joker at heart, so
that wasn't the part that stayed with me. Anyway, so we'll move on because I
chills.
We should wrap it up there so I don't spoilify anything for anyone. If anyone needs counselling after reading The Blood of the Delphi eventually, please get in touch.
You're going to scare them off. It isn't all traumatic. I promise you. It isn't all traumatic. It's got funny bits in it too.
It's not traumatic. You have to read it. You have to read it.
Well, thank you for letting me ramble on there. I feel like I've talked far too much, but yeah. I am open at any time for complaints. For anyone who is around on the 24th as well, obviously I'm going to be doing an online launch to celebrate the release. And I will be going live on Facebook at 5 o'clock GMT, so British time, London time. I will be live on Facebook, but I'll be available throughout the day. So if you have any questions or want any comments or want to expand on anything on the day, ping me a message via my Facebook page. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you for the launch, and I look forward to your outrage. So thanks very much for listening, guys.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.